3 more minutes.
Okay, somebody just joined.
Yeah, Larissa Meyer.
Hi, Larissa. How are you?
Good. How are you all?
We're good. Oh, somebody else? Who just joined?
Hi, David here.
Hello, David.
Hi, David Ransomot. Hello.
Hello.
All right, we're getting there.
Okay, yeah. We're really on the scene.
So you think now is time to start?
Yeah, we can go now.
Okay. All right. Phil, Pam, Kevin, Alicia, and I are here. And all the rest, I think you've heard yourselves introduce yourselves. So we have a good cohort.
Although not everyone has heard everyone else introduce themselves.
Oh.
Maybe just a quick.
Oh, okay. On the phone, can you introduce yourselves?
David Ransomoff.
Teresa Meyer.
Jenny.
That was Jenny.
Jennifer Rubel.
Jill Rubel.
Jill. Jennifer.
Jennifer Crosbell.
And was that it?
I think that's it.
Okay, let's get going. We'll start with the dates. I hope you've entered them into your calendar for next year. And I want to ask if anybody has had any problems with EBMS. It still seems easy to work through.
Yeah, I think we've had an increase in usage, so good job, everyone.
Oh, great, great. Okay. Who just joined?
This is Don.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Fine, Barry. How are you?
Okay. We're just starting the agenda, and we're up to the summary comprehensive review schedule, which you should have in your packets. And today is breast cancer screening and liver cancer prevention.
Just the beginning of liver cancer prevention.
Okay.
Yeah.
The template?
Yeah.
Okay. And then starting in January, you see the rest of the topics and assignments. Then we have changes to summaries, which over the last year we have not been going through in detail. So if anybody saw anything that is particularly problematic, speak now or forever hold your peace.
Or at least till you think about it.
Yes. Okay. And then you have the levels of evidence. Who just joined?
Hi, it's Doug Levine.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
Good.
Okay, we're down to midway through the front page of the agenda, and I don't know if Alicia or Margaret want to say something, but she has listed the contact for legal inquiries, and that, of course, comes up for a few topics, and most particularly now, talcum powder, perineal talc application, and ovarian cancer. Has anybody been contacted after that first week that we talked about? That have? Alicia, you are aware of people, additional people?
Maybe contacted? Not after that first week, but
okay.
People outside of you.
Okay.
Been contacted.
All right.
I've been contacted, but not as a member of the 2EQ editorial board.
Ah, okay. By a J&J attorney or by a plaintiff?
I've been contacted by J&J attorneys for, like, more than a year, but completely unrelated to my role as PDQ.
I see. Okay. Well, I only know about this through the news, but apparently the last two judgments have gone against the plaintiff, one for technical reasons, that is, the suit was brought in the wrong state, and the other because the judge felt like the science wasn't there and basically ruled from the bench, which... I think they're entitled to do. I know they're entitled to do. If they think that the jury, you know, these are questions that should be handled scientifically rather than by the opinion or a majority vote on the jury. But there's the guy, Paul Robertson, in case you are contacted, in your capacity in on the PDQ board. Any... Jancy, on news items that people want to bring up, a paper that you're going to present today, or something you think has changed in a major way that you think is worthy of reporting in the JNCI?
We can also revisit that at the end.
Yeah, we'll bring it up again. Okay, and then we're going to move on to potential new board members. And we have a list of five.
That was sent out in the email I just sent a couple of hours ago for the people who are in WebEx, so
yeah.
I can pull it up as well on your screen.
And so, I know that at least Jill has sent in some background on some of these people. But first, anybody want to speak on behalf of Andrew Gelman? Anybody know him?
I don't know the name, but I don't really know anything about him.
It's Ed Gelman.
So, I think the recommendation comes from me. This is Don.
Uh-huh.
And I know him very well. He was... there was a New York Times article about a month ago, maybe a month and or maybe 2 months ago, and I can circulate that. He has a blog, and you can find the blog by just Googling him, where he talks about all sorts of things. He's a very well-known theoretical statistician. He's Bayesian. And he got involved in a case or a circumstance in sociology, and I forget the person's name, Curry or something like that. I can certainly send it to you. But it was an issue of p-hacking and a particular study, very small study, that gave this investigator lots of reputation and hype, and it was something to do with concentrating and attitude and the way you approach an interview. And if you approach an interview in a particular way, you will be successful, and not if you approach it another way.
Well, there was a study of these, what she referred to as like power poses.
Power poses.
Oh, yes, that's it.
If you would just have someone assume a certain posture, that would change their approach to things and their outlook and their success. You know, on its surface, it sounded a little silly, but nevertheless,
yes.
She certainly ran with it.
Yes, and it's been, as I understand the Times article, largely debunked.
Yes.
And Andrew was the main debunker. It's had an effect to change change sociology. I think it was behind the journal, the sociology journal, Applied Sociology, something or other, that has banned p-values completely. Anyway, he's a very erudite and very gentle person, despite some of the things said about him in the Times.
Okay, so let me ask Alicia, how many more can we put on? Can we put more?
We can put more,
mm-hmm.
But it's about the balance.
What categories do we need to
put? Yeah.
Yeah, so these are generalists primarily, and I think we need to consider where we need subject expertise,
mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that we shouldn't have generalists on the board, but we are lacking in some organ sites.
So let me say, first of all, we have in the last year or two,
right.
I lose track of time, we're getting
yes.
specialists on the board, certainly Larissa,
Jenny,
before them, Jill,
yes.
Doug. We have a number of specialists, so it wouldn't, and a lot of what we do is aimed at generalists, screening and prevention is a general population. Are there specific gaps that we need to fill in, though?
So I would say upper GI, so esophageal and gastric. I've been doing those, but the truth is, especially in prevention rather than screening, I don't really know anything about them.
Hello. Oh, the Vishnu Auditory Point in San Antonio.
Another specialist.
Thank you. Excellent.
Okay.
What is your specialty?
Hi, Ishmael Breast.
Okay, well, that's not upper GI. I think Jenny did is head and neck. So we've got that oral sort of thing.
Well, David, I would think could cover...
David can cover a lot of these, but he's stretched thin. And David and I talked a little bit today. The other one is liver.
Yeah.
But he doesn't feel like he has great depth on liver, and I certainly don't either. So somebody kind of in this part of the body, I think, would be helpful.
Let the record reflect that Pam was circulating her hand around her abdomen.
Upper abdomen.
That's right. Below the rib cage, but above the waist.
Below the trachea, above the waist.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of specialty areas covered, but not everyone. I agree.
Yeah.
So, and Vinayak Prasad also can cover a number of diseases. He's a medical oncologist.
Does he have the time to do it, given...
I don't think anybody knows.
Oh.
He's a prolific writer, but he's dedicated to evidence-based medicine and evidence-based policy. And he may be able to fill in some of those gaps. My guess is if we said your area, your content area would be upper GI and liver, he could do it.
So this is Don. I don't like him. He's a nihilist. He's a dogmatist. He's, what more can I say?
Okay. Well, then it looks like he's off the list, but Andrew Gullman remains on.
Who are the other two? I don't know.
There's Stuart Buck at the Arnold Foundation. I don't know him, but John Barron is also at the Arnold Foundation. I do know him a bit. I've met with him two, three times.
What's the Arnold Foundation?
The Arnold Foundation is a foundation set up by a husband and wife team that are extremely interested in evidence-based policy. And traditionally, it has been social policy and educational policy and things like that. Like, they're very interested in, you know, we often change school policies, we change social policies with no evidence at all. We just follow what seems to be, should work. And so they're very dedicated to developing an evidence base and funding studies, definitive studies of actual policy. And John Barron is the head of, I think, social science there. And he's very dedicated to randomized controlled trials in social science and policy.
So can you write a summary statement?
Well, I don't know, but...
is it the same John Barron that used to say good things about Donald Trump? No?
Oh, it's not the same John Barron who does colorectal cancer. That's what I thought you were going to
say. No, that's a different one.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like Tim. Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Barrons out there.
So I take the point about generalists, and we've got a lot of statisticians on the committee now, and but these are names that could go on the list. Stuart Buck, to say a few words about him, because the name comes from me as well. He is the vice president and head of research at the Arnold Foundation. Some of you know the John Oliver show on scientific studies. If you don't know it, you can Google John Oliver scientific studies, and you'll see a really erudite presentation of the kinds of things we talked about and multiplicities, and even shows and discusses p-hacking. I've been interacting with Stuart for 5-7 years, something like that. The Arnold Foundation is in Houston, and so I've met with him, and we exchange emails all the time, where we try to outdo each other in finding the worst study in the world. And he says, now I have it. I have the worst study. and he is, to tie those two things together, when I saw the Oliver presentation, I said, this is Stuart Buck. And when I saw that one of the Arnold Foundation grantees was interviewed, I knew it was Stuart Buck, and I challenged him on it, and he said, do you want to see my 10,000 plus word exchanges with the producers? So he's the brains and the brawn, really, behind that show.
Okay. Now, Pam, do you have a comment?
Oh, I do have a comment. So I want to bring it back to the fact that we need people who are going to attend meetings, who are going to read the EBMS stuff, and who can write summary statements.
Yes.
So over the last year, I have written 3 or 4 summary statements that I knew nothing about. And yes, I did a good job. I learned a lot. But it took a long time, and I can't keep doing that. So I'd like to see some people on the board
mm-hmm.
to take over those roles who could do it more quickly. It may mean going with folks who are more junior. Junior researchers, they have more to gain from doing this sort of work. They also have more energy than a lot of us do. There are some up-and-coming people just that are floating through my mind. I don't know them all that well, but I can throw their names out. I mean, not in the garbage. I can mention their names. But I really, really think we need to focus on getting the job done and not putting people on the board who will only pontificate.
All right,
Pam. Pam.
Yeah.
I'm willing to do liver.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I have. You know, I'm in. My husband has trained as a donor liver. And we do a lot of liver, a huge amount of liver actually at the VA. So I'm happy to join that team.
You're already on okay. for liver screening. You're right. Not on for liver prevention.
Well, Joe, can you take on prevention?
Actually, I'm better at screening than prevention, but I'd be happy to join in. I also see that on the comprehensive review schedule for liver screening, my name is not listed. I didn't know that I was otherwise included on this particular agenda today. That's why I was mentioning it.
Okay.
But going forward, I can certainly, I am much better at screening than prevention, but I'd be happy to join in with prevention.
Okay. All right. Well, Pam, you're going to be thinking about names. Let's get back right now to this list that we have in front of us. Any objections to extending an invitation to Andrew Gelman and Stuart Buck with the proviso that Alicia will look into whether they have time to spare and are willing to, and they recognize that review of papers and editing and writing is part of the job?
How many spaces do we have roughly?
I think we should be very strategic about
Yeah, and actually I don't know the dermatologist, but I think we would benefit more from having a dermatologist on the board than a lawyer or a statistician at this point.
Do either of these two people have any cancer? It sounds
like David Elfrin does.
Yeah, well, let's talk about
that. Yeah, I think I'm agreeing that I think it's a lot might be better to have cancer folks rather than the journalists and
But I mean, even statisticians or like Stuart Buck, it sounds like they're more in the social science.
Right.
No. We're kind of statistician heavy. Not that I don't like statisticians. I mean, we're awesome.
We don't like statisticians.
But
it's not what we need right now.
Right.
All right, well, then we saw the CV. Let's set aside Andrew Goldman and Stuart Buck then for a while until we figure out if we can get some specialists. David Elpern, I think you sent the CV and had a few. You're high on him, correct?
Yes, I knew of him for some time because we have some friends in common, including the people who run the bioethics and public health sections at Williams College. And I met him recently, though, at a meeting, and I was struck by how in addition to what he does clinically, but also especially beyond what he does clinically, this is a deep interest of his. He shared with me Google Docs of notes and excerpts he had taken from articles that he has read over many years. I gave a presentation, and he put together a Google Doc and sent it to me for my approval and accuracy. He's very distressed by the trend in thresholds for diagnosis of melanoma and the pressure that clinicians and dermatologists in particular are under as a result. Skin checks, the fact that he'll, identify a lesion he believes is indolent, but the patient then goes off to Dana-Farber, where they, they have established different thresholds. They advise most surgeries that, are of equivocal appropriateness. So he's very interested in the issues of thresholds for diagnosis, the potential harms from altering thresholds. I also think he's just very, not that this is necessarily critical for the board, but he's very decent. He asked me to look up a medical student who he had mentored while the student was at Williams College and now at Yale Medical School, because this is a boy from Zimbabwe who has essentially no family. His mother died when he was a child. The father is a poor fish market salesman. He's kind of navigating his way in the world successfully, but without much support. He took the kid under his wing at school when he happened to run into him in a library, seeing him renting DVDs, and he said, "Forget about that. Come spend your free time in my office." That kind of thing. He is distressed by the businessization of practices, and so I think very not a dogmatist, but very well intentioned, interested in medical care for the objective of preventing harm and helping people without some of the side trips and the distractions that it often involves, at least today.
Jill, Kevin and sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it.
So Kevin and I were just doing a search to see what he's published, and we came across this article called Spirituality in Dermatology Practice. Could you speak a little bit to that?
I can.
I don't think he's
flaky. I think he's, he's very well trained, obviously. Most private practitioners don't write anything. I think for a guy who's been in private practice for a long time, he's written a lot of articles. But I can't speak to that now. Our conversations didn't take that trail.
Well, he wasn't the first author on it.
He was the senior one.
And I find it, but now he is relatively senior, I'm assuming, because he's second author or senior author on the first page of stuff, and I don't see a lot of his of stuff where he's the lead author. That's not.
He's a practicing dermatologist. Is that correct?
Yeah, he is in clinical practice. He's not an academician. I think his appointments are clinical appointments.
All right, well, we've spent a fair amount of time, and right now we got nobody that's uniformly endorsed. I think we ought to put a hold on the statisticians. We do have statisticians. Pam is going to give us some specialists. I don't rule out David Alpern, but I didn't sense uniform opinion. So you want to defer, and Pam, you get us names of specialists. And it sounds like Vinay is out. John Barron and Stuart Buck are more social policy types. And let's think some more, okay? All right. Well, that was... I can't... 30 minutes well spent, but let's...
It was
30
minutes.
Yeah, move on. comprehensive reviews. I don't think that Joanne is on, unless
she won't be on.
And Leslie is not.
I'm not sure. Is Leslie?
Leslie?
Yes, Leslie's here.
Oh, hi, Leslie.
Yeah.
And Jill. So, you want to talk about the what I have here is a temporary folder. Temporary.
Only until it's approved here.
Okay. Do you want to talk about your changes?
Yes. So I can start off. well, we did about four meetings actually. One in person before the last board meeting, and then two or three phone calls. But Lee Bill was very good at helping us organize. And so what we did was we took parts of it and just trimmed and consolidated, and then when we were done with that, we reorganized the whole thing. We had help from some of the board members. Thank you, guys, who looked at it for us. We had actually did Judy Perez take a look at it. I can't remember who else, but we had outside people reading it just for smooth reading and content. And then when we were done with all that, then I reorganized the whole the structure. so we did a bunch of cut and paste and gave Lisa a whole bunch more new work to do. But we're pretty happy with how it is right now. It's quite a bit shorter. It's a lot tighter. And the only thing I have to comment on is that on the very first, you know, on the marquee, where we say the benefits of mammography on page 3, the magnitude of effect, in the email that Lisa has sent, there's actually some better, shorter language than the magnitude of effect that's on the hard copy that you all have. And it just tightens it up, and it's easier to read and a little bit simpler. So that's the only additional change we've made, and that gets rid of that table and everything under the magnitude of effect of the benefits of screening with mammography. So with that, I'll see if Jill has anything else to say right now, and then if you guys have had a chance to take a look at it, we'd like to hear your comments, and we will incorporate any changes you suggest, and then I think we're ready to put it up live.
I think it's been a while since I've looked at it, but as I recall, I'm going to send you the other article. There are two screening clinical breast exam trials. I think you only mentioned one. There are two in India. One of them's in the south of India, the other one's in Mumbai. And they both published early data showing downstaging of disease, but we don't have mortality data yet. But the it's just mentioning that there are two ongoing screening clinical breast exam trials, not just one. And we're the mortality data is pending.
And do you know if those are
great? I can add those. Yeah.
Okay. And let's see, Jill, did you have anything to add to that, to what Leslie just said? Must be on mute.
Yeah, we can't hear you, Jill, if you're talking.
Jill? Okay. Any other comments? All right. Looks like we're getting there. Just about there. Now, let's move on to, it says liver cancer screening, but I have prevention in my packet.
Yes, it should be prevention. That was a mistake.
Okay.
Because otherwise I would have spent a lot of time.
Oh, Jill?
Barry?
Yeah?
I had been muted, but I do have a comment.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, I just wanted to point out that, as you may remember at our last meeting, we spent some time debating the overview presentation and how we would present how we would portray the strength of evidence, given the fact that many of the trials were potentially no longer relevant, given the changes in the treatment and the changes in therapy, and also that the benefit of mammography and harms and the balance of the two varies for women. Yes. And so we did a draft, but I think we made significant progress in those nuances in that first couple of sections, particularly the section, the summary of evidence paragraph, and also the screening with mammography benefit section.
You're breaking up the discussion. I'm not sure it's breaking up. I can't hear completely what you're.
Okay. I have no idea where that would be. Can you hear me now?
Yes,
better now. Yes.
Okay. In any event, I just wanted to point out that the matters that we had debated that we thought weren't adequately addressed, specifically the differential balance of benefits and harms in women of different ages, we debated and we rewrote a number of times on the third and fourth pages, and I think that the conclusion is well done, so it couldn't be improved upon further, but much better than
conclusion. You're breaking up again.
That was it.
Okay.
I'm done.
Alright. Alright, good. Thank you. Now we can move on to liver screening.
Prevention.
Prevention.
So, David, do you want me to drive?
Please do.
Okay. So, this is a lot different than the previous summary. We really added, the previous version was really focused on hepatitis and not the other risk factors. So I tried to pull all the possible big risk factors. So we mentioned cirrhosis, that's in the past one, that's here as well. Aflatoxin was mentioned, that's here as well. Alcohol is here. And on David's recommendation, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, so NASH, tobacco use, the rare medical conditions, also non-alcoholic fatty liver and metabolic syndrome and the vaccination. So one thing that was tricky about this one was that everything is kind of intertwined with everything else. So in other words, the presence of hepatitis B or hepatitis C in most instances will affect how strong another risk factor is at increasing risk. Then there are things like alcohol use and tobacco use, which are highly correlated and confounded. We know that heavy alcohol use increases risk because it leads to cirrhosis. Tobacco use maybe some people feel tobacco use has an independent effect. Some people say it's questionable. Then there's the obesity and the metabolic syndrome issues. So obesity, diabetes, and insulin resistance, all very highly correlated, difficult to tease apart. And then there's the issue of cirrhosis, that many of these risk factors operate through cirrhosis, that is, they cause cirrhosis, which then leads to liver cancer, or gives rise, not gives rise, creates an environment in which liver cancer thrives. So what I did was to, where there was effect modification with the presence of the viruses, I handled that within the other risk factor. Also, if there was effect modification with the presence of cirrhosis, I handled that within the risk factor. I can see other formats for this. David felt that, yes, we could do this multiple ways, but we don't have to do it one way or the other. So I was curious what the board thought about the format of it, the way I treated the effect modification, the interrelated variables, and yeah. David, do you have anything to add?
Only that I think this is sort of a special kind of problem, hepatocellular cancer, when we think about prevention, because many of the complicating and intertwined factors, Pam, that you mentioned, which are very, very important, they're major conditions and diseases in themselves which are already getting treated. So we're not talking about giving non-steroidals to otherwise healthy people to prevent something, or hormones for breast cancer, or statins or aspirin or something like that for cardiovascular disease, which is a special kind of prevention problem where we're dealing with healthy people. And I think in a way it makes untangling, I think we want to explain fairly some of the interactions and so forth, but in a way doctors are already going to be treating and managing these otherwise pretty active, separate important diseases. And I'm just sort of thinking out loud that this is an unusual kind of prevention problem. We may not have to sort out all the individual cofactors and confoundings and that sort of thing.
Two other things that I didn't mention. There also are worldwide variation in prevalence of the hepatitises and the aflatoxins. I tried to include the big ones and the important associations, but if we're doing this for primarily an American audience, we may want to think about some of these. Think about that. If it's going to be translated, which it will be for China, then you know we definitely leave the aflatoxins in. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention. So I just wrote the overview. I did not write the guts of it because I wanted to get feedback on the format before I really dove into doing the majority of it.
So I guess I retain aflatoxin for the very reason you said. Any comments about the format? Any people object to it or think it should be changed?
I'm not sure I fully grasp what you were saying. Could you give us one specific example of how you're handling this reaction or confounding?
So for aflatoxin's a good one.
All right.
So if you go to page 5, so the increase in risk is thought to occur in people chronically infected with HPV. There's still a suggestion, like a real large increase is among the HBV people. Scott, there is a study that suggests that in the absence of HBV, there might be an increase in risk as well, but it's meaningfully smaller. And, you know, I have to question whether there's some issues about accurate characterization of HBV, so that these people who are they really HBV negative, or was it a failure in the testing? So that's it. Did that help?
Yeah.
So you're not saying the aflatoxin in and of itself does it cause hepatocellular carcinoma, because I think the evidence is it independently causes,
so
maybe exacerbated by HBV.
Well, the data are limited.
Really?
So what I wrote is maybe on the order of fourfold.
Yeah.
I think what's happening is that we sort of people get things into their minds based on the old studies where you couldn't assess hepatitis. So now that we can assess hepatitis, we have a better understanding of what increases the risk for people who are exposed to aflatoxin. And it's that people who are exposed to aflatoxin tend to live in areas where HBV is endemic.
All true. I've heard Tom Kessler talk about his study. He's at Hopkins, mm-hmm. and Hopkins is well aware of HBV infections.
Right, right.
And he's given whole talks at center almost exclusively on aflatoxin as the carcinogen in certain villages in China. I'd be surprised if Hopkins missed, or Tom Kessler missed, the fact that it's almost all in HBV-infected people.
We can talk about aflatoxin.
Okay.
I don't think it's the most important one here, but
all right.
It's a good example of where...
An interaction.
Two
causes of cirrhosis are highly, highly likely to work synergistically
right,
to give you
right.
liver cancer.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe it has things like alcohol use,
mm-hmm.
where in most instances, nearly all instances, there's cirrhosis of the liver. But there are some instances of people who consume heavy amounts of alcohol having liver cancer but don't have cirrhosis.
Yeah.
So it's like there are all these little caveats.
Well, I'm not sure that fine-tuning is going to be necessary.
I wanted to bring up that situation.
Okay.
In this one.
Yeah, there's just multiple causes. So somebody had a comment.
I wonder, Pam, whether you would consider making two separate sections for chronic hepatitis B and C, since they have, they actually are associated with significantly different risks, prevention, the approaches to prevention are different. We treat them like very different diseases, at least in our chronic liver disease clinics.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are enough distinctions between the two that would be very.
We can separate them, and of course, in the guts of the document, there will be a lot more information to differentiate. A lot of the issues that you bring up will be discussed.
Okay. All right, any comments before we move on?
I've got a comment. It'd be useful, given that most of the Americans support the ones that are more prevalent in the U.S. up before something like aflatoxin, or is it based on the risk, do you think? Because NASH is much more, probably more common than aflatoxin.
Yeah, that's true.
I think I did it based on the degree of increase in risk.
Okay.
But they can very easily be swapped.
Yeah, you could do it either way, but I just feel like if I was reading this, I'd want to read about MASH or read about aflatoxin, which is not as relevant to me.
Yeah, I agree. MASH is on its way up. Aflatoxin is probably on its way down because there are international efforts to change the food stuff from corn to rice and better storage.
So would you want non-alcoholic fatty liver higher up as well, like before the rare diseases?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, NAFL is they're in a different area. NAFL is in the.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. Never mind.
I just love the word NAFL.
NAFL.
I like it.
NAFL.
All right, Jenny. Did you have another comment?
No.
Okay, thanks.
Just one quick comment. If you are not speaking and moving around, maybe mute yourself, because it's sometimes hard to hear other people. So, thanks.
Right, and I think that doesn't pertain to Jenny, because she's next up.
Nope.
So, now we're up to oral cavity screening and prevention summaries with proposed changes. And these are number 6 and number 7, and I think... Jenny, you're on the list to discuss them.
Okay. Well, first of all, hearing you speak half an hour about potential new board members, I appreciate being approved, and I have enjoyed my time here so far. I'm going to speak about 3 broad categories of change I made these 2 documents. I was tasked with adding an article of nasopharyngeal cancer to the scheme, but then that more and more changes. Then I add nasopharyngeal cancer to the with the that we would have to change the title of the whole section because nasopharyngeal cancer is not an oral cavity or oropharyngeal cancer. And then because we were adding nasopharyngeal cancer, it would make sense to exclude laryngeal cancer and hypopharyngeal cancer, which is actually more common than nasopharyngeal cancer in the United States. So then I had to add them all. And so that, looking at the screening document, that resulted in the section on overview, which I wrote further down on that document, leadership is scrolled down.
Mm-hmm.
This is the top of that document. And I felt a little bit higher. Yeah, just there. And I also found that there was a link to more details about head and neck cancer, another NCI summary, with a diagram. So I just put a link to that. If we move on to the second and third page, or the third page in particular, I had a section on laryngeal, hypopharyngeal, and nasopharyngeal cancers in terms of the interest of that one. Then I, if you scroll down a bit further, I have to talk about the other main risk factors for EBV under risk factors. Fortunately for hypopharyngeal and laryngeal cancers, risk factors smoking and alcohol resistance. Then the second big change I made to the document was that with most of the articles she chose were actually referring to laryngeal and hypopharyngeal as well as alcohol and smoking. But for the rest of those she had that weren't referring to those cancers, I added a couple more. And that's reflected in the overview as well as the detailed description. And the other idea was just a little bit of housekeeping. If you look at the first page of, say, the prevention document, everybody, you've got your own copy. I thought that HPV didn't need to be discussed on its own. It could be moved up with the other risk factors. So I moved HPV up, EBV, because that was relevant to nasopharyngeal. And then a couple of the other things was there was a little bit of confusion between oral cavity and oral pharynx in some of the texts. And then I added specific comments about articles if they were referred to under the magnitude effect. I ended up with this. So there are two major revisions to two of the articles. And the more I look at it, I could have done more, but because I ran out of time. I think in the future we could look into diet a little bit more for nasopharyngeal and hypopharyngeal, but once again, they're not as relevant to the American audience.
So, Jenny, the reason why I had HPV apart from the top was because, to my understanding, it's only associated with oropharyngeal cancer, not oral cavity cancer. So I didn't want people misinterpreting it as being associated with both cancers. So having these under the larger heading of head and neck cancer, squamous cell cancer, to me, I'm concerned that people will assume that they're associated with all head and neck cancer.
Definitely in the detailed description, there was a study which showed that there was a risk factor for other cancers as well, but just not as large. So there was a relationship with both oral cavity and nasal and larynx, which was a twofold odds ratio. So I've elaborated on it. Let's see. Yeah, and then under magnitude of effect under the summary, we would specifically mention that it's oropharyngeal as well. Because, I mean, you could say the same thing about EBV. I mean, EBV is only associated with nasopharyngeal cancer, so it just makes the OBV really complex if we list them separately.
Well, yeah, and that's, yes, it is very complex. And, yeah, I would say the same thing about EBV, that having it under that heading, some people might think it means it's involved in all head and neck cancers, squamous cell cancers. I realize that it gets complicated because we have basically five different cancers. One question that comes to my mind is why nasopharyngeal and hypopharyngeal weren't included in the first place. And that actually is a bigger question, because when you look at the summaries that we do for prevention, there are cancers that we don't have summaries for, like we don't have lymphoma prevention, we don't have leukemia prevention, we don't have testicular prevention. And I think that, I'm sure there are historic reasons for that, maybe because of the incidence being low, but no, so then why have we just not gotten around?
There aren't any real interventions that are of interest or not studied. You know, it's just the paucity of information. Nothing there.
So I think you can certainly add to this, you know, we were focused on information about if there was something known about a prevention intervention, then we have a summary. That's why the liver one focused almost completely on hepatitis. And what we've kind of gone to now is what we're trying to do is to be more complete in terms of listing what the risk factors are. In many cases, there may not be a prevention intervention, you know, that goes along with it. So it's kind of a little bit of a switch in the way we're doing this. But I want to mention with this one, and Pam, you're well aware of this, that this used to be prevention of oral cancer.
Right.
And we got quite a bit of flack you know, because we did not separate out oropharyngeal and oral cavity cancer in terms of the risk factors and the HPV. So I think we have to be, I understand how this is organized, and it may come down to trying to change the title of the heading. I don't know how to do it, but I think your point is really well taken. So I just want to say that because I don't know if Patty knows the history of why it kind of got written the way it was.
Yeah. Well, it's really helpful to hear the explanation of why some things are included and some things aren't included. Prevention is not always the same thing as etiology. But we often, but they overlap. I mean, I think we're trying to provide the best information to people, and I think it's useful to list the risk factors, even if they're not, there isn't a good prevention strategy.
Well, do you think that that's sufficient reason to have a whole statement, just so we can list risk factors for a disease for which there's no screening test and no interventions for prevention?
No, I mean, this all came about when we started doing the risk factor
project,
you know, which the FDA, you know, the problem is that, for example, we have a genetics of skin cancer summary. So they're focused on genetic risk factors. They're focused on the familial cancer syndromes that predispose to skin cancer. But there's a lot of places where there's an interaction between the phenotype and so they were going into a lot of detail about risk factors for skin cancer and interventions that was already covered in our summary.
Yeah.
So in trying to make this distinct, so they took a lot of that and they linked to the skin cancer summary, and then you start reading the skin cancer summary and all it focused on was sun exposure, because that's the preventable, you know, risk factor. And so it's tricky. Like, that's, you know, we're trying to, so this board became the holder of the information about risk factors.
Yeah.
And we're just starting doing the ones that are covered by this board. So theoretically, there is a prevention. We wouldn't have a prevention summary if there weren't some prevention strategies
right.
The ones that are covered.
So it seems, I don't know, we could still be the board that looks at risk factors even if we don't have an evidence statement for screening or for prevention, since there are none. But it seems like it's we could be incurring a big load or a lot of work.
Well, I'm not suggesting that. All I'm saying is that, you know, we have to have some place. If we say, here are the risk factors for skin cancer, look at the skin cancer prevention summary, and you only list the ones that there's a prevention strategy for, then that's what happened. I mean, in the adult treatment summary, we have, like, a few of them listed. So it looked, people, it's very inconsistent information. So this was trying to be the place where you list what the risk factors are, and then if there are whatever ones there are prevention strategies for, you give the evidence for that. And the others is just like information. But it's not like we're thinking of creating summaries on all these different cancer types just to list the risk factors. It was just more that we already had these summaries, so it was a way of making them more complete.
Yeah, I mean, for EBV, for instance, you can't really think of that, but it would be a huge, a huge piece of the puzzle missing from this if we didn't include that, since we talk about it in the screening document.
Yeah, another thing is that it's really hard for a lot of people to talk about one aspect alone. So it's hard to talk about it's just that you can talk about genetics, but anybody who's well-versed in that is also probably going to want to talk about risk factors that may affect, that may be relevant. So, it's very difficult.
The first part of all of these summaries, the prevention summaries, who's at risk. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to make sure that we had, you know, whatever risk factors we decided were risk factors, that they were included here.
Yeah, well, I sense if we have a statement, then that, you know, we can have the risk factors there. But when we don't have a statement, we shouldn't create a statement.
No,
just so,
and I've never
okay.
been,
all
never
right.
been
then
advocating.
That's
that.
Fine. Let's get back to this statement. And Jenny, I don't know if you were finished, but let me just ask you, under diet, you know, page 3.
Yeah.
You just give a reference for dietary factors that might contribute, and that obviously is often an area of controversy. How strong is the evidence, and is it real? And you don't list what the dietary factors are, nor the evidence behind them. So I'm wondering if you should expand the section or just take out that sentence. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, it says hypothyroidal cancer, that it's actually the prevalence that is in Asia, particularly Pakistan and India. And the dietary things they're talking about are not just sort of part of the American diet. So I'm happy to read it.
Okay, any objections to that?
And then the same thing for nasopharyngeal cancer. There are aspects in Asian diets like salted fish that people talk about. And I didn't mention it there because I felt like I had enough, but I can delete the hypopharyngeal part.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds reasonable. One minor question is in the next paragraph you talk about EBV. And you say EBV exposure, rather than, I'm guessing, but I'm not sure, you'll know the evidence better than I, that it is not simply exposure, it's persistent infection, since 90% of people are exposed.
So in my reading, 90% of people are exposed and have had it, and then the people with active nasopharyngeal cancer either newly diagnosed or persistent after treatment or recurrent have markers that indicate they've got active EBV.
Okay, so then maybe that should be changed to persistent infection or something like that.
But you have to be exposed in order to have it. The theory is that you have to, it's like the aflatoxin, you have to have the EBV, but then you have the genetic abnormality in the cells.
Right.
And you can argue the same thing for Asian ancestry. We all have it. I have it, but I don't have nasopharyngeal cancer.
Right. So, I drew a parallel with, like, cervical cancer, where, exposure to HPV is a risk factor, but we say that the real risk factor is persistent infection, since almost all infections are cleared, and in a relatively small proportion of women, they're not cleared, and those are the ones that, and the only ones, that are at risk for cervical cancer.
So you want me to change that word to exposure to infection?
Yeah, because it will be, almost everybody is exposed. When 90% or more of the population are exposed, but it's only those that have a residual infection that get it. It seems that the phrasing would be persistent infection.
So the other thing I want to mention is just that we've been trying to put most of the risk factor information in the prevention summary.
Yes.
And so I don't know if it may be important to have it here in terms of explaining the screening, but it's also, we are going to have a lot of information about risk factors.
I was it was just based on the previous format. I thought it was
Okay, well, maybe one more, Margaret's suggestion is when you go through it one more time to see if you can economize by pulling things out of screen and just refer them to prevention.
Just that one.
Does that also go for the under prevention? There's a, under overview, there's a who's at risk.
Yeah, that's where we go. Risk factors.
Okay. Do you leave that there? Is that right? That's an overview.
Yes.
Okay.
And so with respect, we've already agreed that the diet will come out of these unusual cancers where the foods are so rarely found here. And I have edits for you. That's great. Any other comments from either Jenny or others? Okay. Now we'll move on to skin cancer screening. Jennifer. And you were going to talk about the Pampina article. Jennifer, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm on the line. There's not that much to say. It's just we just added a little sentence that had to do with talking about de novo melanomas versus ones that appear later.
Great. That's on page 4. On page 4, you have added text that most melanomas do not arise from pre-existing nevi, and I softened that to say may not arise, since the study design was really a cross-sectional histology study, so I wanted to leave some wiggle room for a possibility that it came to the wrong conclusion. Does that sound fair to you?
That's fair.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks. Now we're up to lung cancer prevention, and this is Jennifer, and I don't think Tony is on. So Jennifer, page 13.
Oh yeah, so this was initiated because the original reference was out of date. So Tony's the one who actually was good enough to find a new reference for us. So this is really just updating. The estimate actually ended up being exactly the same, but this is just an updated reference of the attributable risk.
Great. Thanks. Now we'll move on to prostate cancer screening, which I thought was missing.
It was missing, yeah.
Okay.
Because there was some discussion about this paper, so we can save that till later on.
Okay.
If you want, and we can, yeah.
All right. Then ovarian cancer prevention and screening, that's item number 10. Larissa, you had a number of changes. On pages 4 and 10, it was just the references, but on pages 3 and 5.
Right, so these are changes that are based off of the pool article that I presented at our last meeting. And the reason why we discussed these changes was that previously in our document, we had listed endometriosis as a risk factor and then did not really discuss it at any other point in the document. Mm-hmm. And so if you look on page 3, basically I added a sentence there, associations of subgroup factors with ovarian cancer vary by histopathologic subtype. The association of endometriosis with ovarian cancer is stronger for non-serous subtypes, such as clear cell carcinoma and endometrioid cancers. And that came from the pool paper that we discussed. We also added a little section in the overview on page 5, a little section on endometriosis, which again discusses its unfair evidence given the cohort case control studies that self-reported and laparoscopically confirmed endometriosis is associated with ovarian cancer.
Right.
And then repeated the histologic subtypes.
All right. Any comments? Sounds good. Thank you. And now we're moving on to special topics, I think. And this is it's clear that there was a spectrum of opinion surrounding this issue, obesity and cancer risk. Tony isn't on the line, But
he's going to join later.
Yeah, so. Don, you want to defer and see if he gets on and talk about it when he gets on?
He's going to join around 2, so if you want to wait till then.
Okay. Then let's put that on hold for a bit. The one thing I think we can discuss and agree to, even without Tony, is that in the statement there was a reference to a well-known group, AICR, that basically puts most of its efforts into associations for diet and cancer, and they tend to lean towards saying that there are associations and they are causal, which wouldn't necessarily be in sync with our approach to evaluating the evidence. And in general, we avoid referring to the conclusions of another panel, except under very special circumstances, when we're looking for cover of authority, so to speak. And for example, we do that with talc exposure and ovarian cancer, that basically saying we think the evidence is inconsistent or weak, and then we refer to a well-known society that has done an analysis and say that they've concluded that there's no association. We did that with abortion and breast cancer as well. But with those rare exceptions, we try to avoid referencing other groups as though we are blessing their conclusion.
So how is this different?
It differs because I think we don't fully agree with the AICR, that's number one.
Okay.
And there isn't a hot controversy with lawsuits and on and on, or advocacy groups that are calling for legislation against abortion and therefore are scrutinizing, you know, every word that we say. So we want to say that the associations are weak, but nevertheless, we also want to say that for this particularly politically sensitive item, there are other groups that feel the same way.
I think when I've either looked into stuff that we've cited using that, or when I've needed to add a citation, it was more out of ease than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
That it was just that they have this report where they I don't think there was any malice.
I'm not attributing evil motivations.
Right.
I'm just saying that when we usually avoid just simply giving the conclusion of another panel because we just give it ourselves. Okay. But we're going to come back to the substance of the association with obesity and various cancers and whether interventions change that. And we'll wait for Tony. Okay, Don, you're going to be on the rest of the time because I know you weighed in through your emails too.
Yes, I'm going to be on.
Great. All right, now we're going to move to articles for review. Ovarian cancer prevention and screening. Larissa has the Kuchenbaker paper.
So this is a paper that was recently published in JAMA, looking at a very large prospective cohort study of almost 10,000 individuals with BRCA1 and BRCA2 germline mutations. The majority of the patients came from familial clinics, with a very small minority, 6%, being from population-based studies. I think if we turn to figure 1, that's sort of a nice job of breaking down the analysis cohorts. Specifically, they were looking at three things. One was breast cancer risk in people previously unaffected. A second thing was ovarian cancer risk, again, in people previously unaffected. And the third question was contralateral breast cancer risk in people who had a prior breast cancer diagnosis. You can see here that people who had risk-reducing surgeries were excluded from the cohorts. overall they were looking at standardized incident ratios for these three questions. In addition, they looked at a variety of other things, including, for example, the relationship of other family members with cancers in terms of penetrance and developing new cancers, as well as the location of the genetic mutation in terms of the specific mutation and the subsequent risk of breast and ovarian cancer. They did a significant number of analyses and sensitivity analyses on this group of patients and a very large supplemental file as well. Overall, this is, you know, I think it's probably one of the most updated and largest studies looking at cancer incidence in these high-risk genetic carriers. I think overall the numbers are not that different from what we've seen from a lot of the prior studies. Overall, breast cancer risk peak incidence occurred in the 41 to 50-year-old age group at 28.3 for 1,000 person years. They saw a similar pattern for BRCA2 carriers, the peak incident slightly later, which is similar to what we see in ovarian cancer. So a peak incidence in the 51 to 60-year-old age group at 30.6 per 1,000 person years. But in terms of ovarian cancer risk, ovarian cancer cumulative risk to age 80 was 44% for BRCA1 carriers and 17% for BRCA2 carriers, and you can see those in more detail on table 2 and figure 2. Lastly, in terms of the contralateral cancer risk, the hazard ratio for contralateral breast cancer they found declined with increasing age at first cancer diagnosis, with even so compared to baseline, if you were diagnosed at 40 to 50, you had a hazard ratio of 0.81. And even lower at 0.71 if your first cancer diagnosis was after age 50. I think some of the more interesting parts of this paper was looking because they have the numbers to do so, was looking at the incidence for patients who had a strong family history. Breast cancer estimates for both BRCA1 and BRCA2 carriers increased accordingly with the number of first and second spouses that had cancer, which makes sense clinically. They did not see a significant difference in ovarian cancer, but I believe that this is likely because the number of events was smaller for ovarian cancer, so probably they didn't have the power to see that. You did see a trend towards similar outcomes, but nothing yet. This was the other kind of nice piece here was looking at the breast and ovarian cancer risk by mutation position, which I think is sort of a newer thing. I think overall, no study's perfect, but I think that this is one of the largest and nicest studies that I've seen with this in a while. In my opinion, the current information that we have in our document for prevention and for screening, we really don't touch deeply on the BRCA or genetic components because there's a separate PDQ summary on genetics of breast and gynecologic cancers. And so I think the details in this paper, at least currently, are outside of the scope of what we have in our document.
Okay, so you just want to add the reference to what we do say about the genetic syndromes. We already have a reference in here to the genetic board. So are you just suggesting what you should add in the reference here?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Any questions about that? Sounds good.
Yeah, this is Doug. Just one quick question. I agree with the nice presentation Larissa gave. It seems to me, you know, one or two of the cohorts were from family registries or genetic clinics, and so I just wonder if it's possible some of the estimates, although they're in line with what's been reported, might be a little overestimated because of the ascertainment bias.
Yeah.
Yeah. So But they looked at that, and it's true, and they talk about that being, you know, in their paper. But they've done sensitivity analyses regarding that as well. But they, okay. But they definitely recognize that in the manuscript.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you, Doug, it's not, and maybe I'm wrong, but not simply ascertainment bias. It may well be
no.
that the actual penetrance differs for the same gene when you have a heavy family history versus when you have no family history. Is that correct?
For sure. I used the wrong word. It was more something like enrichment because there's some strong family.
Yeah. Okay.
That's correct.
Larissa, this is David. Can I ask you a question about what does our document currently suggest if a consumer were to look and try to understand what risk might be if they had screening done on a gene analysis done on their own, for example? I'm sort of wondering, and just in follow-up to Doug's question, about whether does our statement at all suggest, does it make clear the distinction between family-discovered markers discovered in affected families versus general population and how unresolved that is?
So the way, I just found the prevention in front of me right now, not the screening, but in terms of the prevention, what we have currently written is risk factors for ovarian cancer include a personal history of breast cancer or a family history of breast and or ovarian cancer and inheritance of deleterious mutations in BRCA1, BRCA2, and selected other high penetrance genes. And then we have a line that says refer to the PDQ summary on genetics of breast and gynecologic cancers for more information. Then if we look sort of on the overview where it goes into more depth, we really have very little information there as well. We do have family history and inherited susceptibility to ovarian, fallopian tube, and primary peritoneal cancer as a factor with adequate evidence of increased risk. And then it just is based on solid evidence women with a family history of ovarian cancer, especially in a first degree relative and those with inherited predispositions to ovarian cancer, such as a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, have an increased risk of developing ovarian cancer. And then again, it refers to the PDQ summary of on genetics of breast and gynecologic cancers.
Okay.
Yeah, that's probably well handled. And I'm assuming, without knowledge, that the genetics board actually does go into those issues.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That's our biggest summary.
Okay. Well, great.
The prevention is like, it's not really a modifiable risk factor.
It is.
Your genetics isn't really a
modifiable risk factor. No, not the genetics.
I mean, the BRCA. That's why it's like putting it in here is like, here's a bit and then leaving the bulk of it for somebody else, I think, is appropriate.
It's exactly the same. It got added back when, we were looking at risk factors for ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
It got added in.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe
we didn't have anything in there.
Yeah. Right. The risk factor is not modifiable, but the risk is.
Right.
And that,
right.
I'm sure they cover. Okay. Thank you, Larissa. Let's move on to lung cancer screening. Jennifer, the Pachi paper.
Okay. You guys can hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so this is a small-ish randomized control trial from Europe. So there's actually a whole bunch of these small ones going on throughout Europe that's looking at low-dose CT screening for lung cancer. So this one's got about 3,000 smokers, direct smokers, with at least 20 pack years in the last 10 years, and the ages are 55 to 69 years. What they did is they had 4 rounds of screening with low-dose CT. And the control group then got what was called usual care, so not screening. And what they did for that then, you can take a look if you want to sort of see how that shook out. If you look at figure 1 on 827, that wound up being about 1,500 in each arm. And so then what they were looking at for their outcomes, the primary endpoint was lung cancer mortality, and actually, as I said, it's a small study, so it was significantly underpowered for this. The NLST was many, many times larger than this, so basically what they said was they did a power calculation that was assuming that they were going to pool together with all these other little trials that are going on in Europe right now. So they thought what they really needed was a sample size that was between 15,000 and 18,000 subjects to see a 25% reduction in lung cancer mortality. So they don't have that, obviously, but they knew they didn't have it starting out. The secondary outcome that they were looking for was death from any cause. They're also looking at the incidence of lung cancer, and sort of falling from that, they looked at overdiagnosis, which is probably the most interesting part of this to talk about in a minute. So results from this, if you look at table 3, which is on 828, they found lung cancer-specific mortality, the rate ratio there was 0.7, and the confidence interval crosses 1 by a little bit, and that's after about 9.3 years of follow-up. So trending in the right direction, but not statistically significant, which is not surprising. Overall mortality, the rate ratio was 0.83, and again, we've got a confidence interval that crosses 1 by a little bit, but trending in the right direction. Looking at lung cancer incidence, so this is where it starts to get a little bit more interesting. So if you look at figure 2, which is at the top of that same page on 828, so they're giving you kind of just a crude rate in the active group and the control group, sort of a cumulative number of lung cancer cases. So this is a little bit interesting because for some reason they only calculate this going out to 8.5 years of follow-up, even though they had longer information for mortality. So I don't know why they did that. I don't know why they didn't have more information, but there you have it. So what you're seeing here is the incidence of the rate ratio is actually 0.93, but that's not statistically significant as well. So the confidence interval for this was 0.67 to 1.30. So no difference between the two arms, and what they're actually showing you here is that there were more cancers by the time you got to the end by a little bit that they found in the control arm relative to the intervention arm. So the deficit was about 4 cancers altogether, and you've seen it sort of crossing over between 6 and 7. So this is a little weird because it was a little bit unexpected because what we've seen in most of the other trials that have come out so far, like the NLST or one of the European trials, which is called the Danish Lung Cancer Screening Trial, is that you had a persistent excess of incident cases in the screening arm, which would suggest overdiagnosis. So it's sort of funny because these authors don't put that in context at all, and instead they use this to basically say, well, there's no overdiagnosis in lung cancer screening at all, which I don't really find terribly convincing. I can't explain why this happened the way it did, except to say, it's a small study, and so perhaps there's just, it is what it is. But I would just point out that they didn't really put this into context to really help us explain it. So like I said, in the NLST, there certainly was an excess of cancers when they did a sort of the same kind of graph with the crude cumulative number of lung cancer cases. And in fact, then Paul Pinsky went on to do a more formal analysis trying to look at overdiagnosis, where you actually have a denominator that you were looking at, not just the sort of crude number of cases. And he found a potential ceiling of about 18%, the rate of overdiagnosis at about 7 years. And the Danish lung cancer screening trial that I mentioned, so that was at 10 years of follow-up, which is longer than this one, actually. There was about a 2 times excess of lung cancer screening in the screening arm, so it was about 5 cases versus 2 cases per 1,000 person-years. And there's some other lines of evidence that are suggesting an excess of or overdiagnosis in lung cancer screening. So one thing these authors tried to do, if you go to figure 4, which is on 830. They try to use this as, so what this thing is, it's lung cancer survival curves by surgery and group. So what they did is they split out people that got screening and then they got treatment versus, not so resected versus unresected. So treatment groups and then screening and unscreening. They basically use this as a justification too to say that there's no overdiagnosis, but I think this is pretty biased, and you can't really use it to make that argument because, I think for the treatment arm, the resected arm, you might not see a difference between those that got treatment and then they were cured in the screened arm versus those in the control arm and were, cured. And I think the lead time probably might not be long enough to see the difference as well. So, I just don't think it's a convincing argument. So it's a really long-winded way of saying that overall, it's good to have the randomized control trial coming out on low-dose screening, but from the perspective of the lung cancer mortality outcome, I don't think it's going to add much to what the PDQ has already, which is we have language in there saying that there's multiple small low-dose trials that are ongoing, and we reference that. And then from the point of view of overdiagnosis, I am not convinced that there's anything to add from the trial except, you know, it seems to have an inconsistent finding but doesn't convince me that there isn't any. So I guess I'll stop there.
Okay, two things. So, Jennifer, since it is the randomized trial and people are waiting for results from all randomized trials, do you intend to just simply put it in as an extra reference with no further discussion?
You could. You've already got a sentence in there that says other randomized control trials of L-DOSE-CD are underway in a number of countries, and we've got a reference there for it.
Okay, but you might want to have this reference in since it's the most recent update, right?
Yeah, we can, if you want.
Well, I would just think that since it's randomized and since, you know, you referred to it, this is sort of the most recent report, I guess I'd put it in.
That's fine.
I do have a question that caught my attention, and this is in Table 3, and I flagged it. You know, the relative risk from of death from cardiovascular disease was 0.51, and the 95% confidence interval was 0.3 to 0.85, and the p-value was actually the smallest in the entire table, 0.009, and it was, you know, the numbers are small, 22 versus 42, but I didn't see a real explanation why the reduction in cardiovascular death would be larger and more statistically significant in the screened arm than in the unscreened arm. That
unbalanced randomization.
Well, that always brings to mind when you see differences of that magnitude, brings to mind the possibility that the two populations were not identical.
Yeah, but Table 1 suggests that they were.
Excuse me. No one has come and said this to Francisco. Did we heard we're supposed to evacuate? There's a fire? People are leaving the building. We're over here, we haven't heard an announcement, but we've been there.
Nothing.
It's apparently broken.
Has there been an email about it?
We see people leaving. There's a fire that's nearby, so.
Is it actual fire, or this is a...
We didn't want to leave without talking to you.
A fire on the sixth floor?
What DCG do you do now?
Thanks
for coming
here.
Okay.
If you took a drill, it would be awful. Well, no. The only thing I say, this is a fire that was started by DCEG.
Our lights, some of them.
I wonder if this is just a drill.
Well, chances are it's just a drill. But we should have been notified in this room. So, the last time we had a drill.
Well, we burn alive.
Please be safe.
Yeah,
I thought have 2 floors to go.
Yeah, that was an anomaly, other than the overdiagnosis. That was an anomaly to see an actual larger reduction in death from cardiovascular disease, highly statistically significant, with no further explanation. And even if Table 1 shows balance, it sure doesn't prove that there were equivalent populations.
No, but this study has a lot of the data in here are very appealing. The kinds of things you'd like to see in terms of various parts of a trial as it goes forward.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, it's unfortunate, the sample size isn't 10 times bigger.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
If you look at the numbers in Table 3, the absolute difference in these numbers is small.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had 30,000 people instead of 3,000, a difference of 20 or 30 wouldn't really be significant. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what you're dealing with is small numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like they picked out cardiovascular from, you know, this multiplicity issue. They maybe just picked it out because it looked good. And something else is going the other way.
The fire department has cleared the building. The fire alarm has cleared the building. There's no longer danger. Please proceed back to your workstation and continue working.
Oh, so those on the line, you can rest easy now. We're safe.
We're not burned alive.
So,
you lived through it.
Although Barry, I think Barry's so cold, I think he was kind of wanting to have a fire come down here just a little bit to warm up.
So I think it is worth putting the reference in, but I think this is too small to say much of anything.
Okay.
And in terms of the overdiagnosis, there is a fair amount of time after the last screen in this trial, more so than NLSC. And with longer follow-up than NLSC, we may find that it goes down.
So
I think that question is unresolved, and this may or may not be an anomaly once all the trials report. So I think it's just too small to really say anything.
All right.
So also, I think Table 1, I don't think they have enough information to demonstrate that the groups are really similar.
And somebody's on the line with you. Okay.
So one of the things that, I mean, I guess the other thing is with these small trials, you're going to see imbalances unless there's stratification. So it may be worthwhile just pointing out that one of the issues of these small trials is the, if they're not stratified, you're going to see imbalances between the study and the control arms.
Yeah. Well, for now, I think all we're going to do is add the reference, and since we're not even putting in the results, we're not going to get caught up in that. But that's a good point. Okay. Thank you.
Can I add something? The reference that existed is actually a review article, and the Nelson study that's mentioned in detail that doesn't have a reference to it. So, and I found that to my fiction when I was reviewing it as well. There were some of the references that didn't match up, maybe because they had been added on subsequently and put everything out of order.
That could be a problem.
We can add the primary.
Okay. All right. Very good. Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Jenny. All right. We're going to move on to prostate cancer screening. And unfortunately, Paul could not be here, even though he is a co-author. But that would have been such a substantial delay in discussing it that we might as well discuss it, because I know that Don had thoughts about it. Letters to the editor came in, including from our own two letters from our statisticians. And this is the one that Peter Boyle responded to, I think, with Tony Miller. With OTA. So I asked Don if he would be willing to discuss this paper, and he has also sent in what I think is a relevant correspondence from Paul to another report of a randomized trial that put more emphasis on a derivative analysis. So, Don, can you discuss the paper?
Yes, thanks, Barry. I'll try to tie those pieces together. Just one additional piece. This, by the way, I have not seen the letters to the editor that you mentioned, and I didn't know about them. I assume that you'll help me if those differ from anything I say. The context, I first found out about this when it was to appear for publication from the media. When I saw the paper, I told from several sources, not because of PDQ, nor because of CISNET, but I'm a member of CISNET, generally, I was asked to comment, and I had to decline because I'm part of the group that put this together. This is CISNET. This is mostly the, well, exclusively the prostate cancer modeling part of CISNET, led by Ruth Azzioni, but the various prostate cancer models have contributed to this. And Rocky Foyer, who is the guru of CISNET, is also a co-author. So I, and with Paul as a co-author, I had to decline. And it would have not been too good for me to have been criticizing my own group. But I'm very critical. I think in the end this should not be included in the PDQ statements, and I'll try to say why. So what they do is they try to understand the difference between ERSPIC and PLCO on the prostate side. And they do it with something called MLTs, mean lead times. But if you go to table one, and look at the, I don't know if you can point to it, Alicia, but if you look at prostate cancer deaths, for the two groups, the ERSPIC and the PLCO, either the all-available follow-up or the restricted to 11 years of follow-up, you'll see that there is quite a substantial difference in numbers of deaths and rate of death in the control arm of ERSPIC, but not in PLCO. And one of the reasons for that that the authors indicate is the contamination, and the greater contamination in PLCO. And that's manifest in the figure one, if you go down just a bit and check figure one. It indicates what the mean lead time lead times are in the various groups. FHCRC is Fred Hutch, MISCAN is the Erasmus model, and UMich is the University of Michigan model. So the three models in the empirical, but they all show roughly the same thing, namely that the mean lead times in the control arms of the PLCO are substantially greater than the corresponding MLTs in ERSPIC. And the reason for that is that there was more screening in the PLCO control arm. So what these modelers do is they look at the a key phrase here is, if you go back to the previous page in methods and look down the third paragraph, the second paragraph of the overview, about halfway down that paragraph, it says, to overcome this limitation, the limitation of the differences between the two, they performed an extended analysis that accounted for the diagnostic work and the variable screening intensity. That is, to put it most simply, they are looking at screen patients and not intention to treat. And that is the, I of course recall the LaBrie paper that showed in a Canadian study that there was a 69% reduction in prostate mortality if you were screened than if you were not screened. And what they did for that analysis, the LaBrie folks did, is that they just combined ignored the randomization and showed by screening versus not screening. And it was a big deal back then. This was in the late 90s, the turn of the century. It was presented in a plenary session of ASCO, LaBrie's analysis. Happily, the discussant was more astute than the people who chose this for plenary in pointing out that it was not intention to treat. And if you look at the LaBrie data by randomization, there's no difference. And so Paul wrote an erudite letter to the editor of the journal, Prostate, at the time, and that's what Alicia sent to you earlier, and he debunks the whole thing and wasn't unique in doing that. Other people, including that discussant in ASCO, pointed this out. So what the article that we have in front of us does is it, in effect, uses the, in that figure one, remember, that you saw that showed the mean lead times, it uses the data mostly in ERSPIC on the who got screened and who didn't get screened to support and to borrow into, in a very strong way, the results in the PLCO. And so what you see, if you go down to the results and the table of results, table two. You see the reduction due to screening, to actual screening, and you see in the ERSPIC and the PLCO really comparable numbers. And that's because essentially ERSPIC is being used in PLCO. So I don't know what words to use, but it's spoken mirrors. I find it embarrassing, actually, that this article would appear. So one thing we could do is to actually include it and say something like this. But I think that the best way is to simply not include it. But I wonder if we could certainly hear from other people who wrote letters, but also Paul. I'm disappointed Paul is not on, because I'm really interested in what he would say in view of the previous instance, the LaBrie correspondence. I'm surprised that he's actually on this. Anyway, Barry and others who have opinions, please.
Don, this is Tim. I agree with that criticism, and I also think that they've continued to make the same mistake in analyzing the ERSPEC trial. They continue to call it a trial. It's actually what, 7 different trials, each with its own protocol, each with its own data collection system, each with its own definition of the treatment. Sometimes the randomization is different. The definition of a positive is different. The strategy for diagnostic follow-up differed, and in such a way that the individuals getting screening were subjected to more vigorous treatments than those who didn't get screening, and this doesn't address any of that. And I'm as shocked and dismayed as you are, not only in the folks whose name is on me, who I would have expected more from, but also for the analysts for not doing a more rigorous job of reviewing the chief answer before deciding to publish it.
Yeah, I agree, Tim.
I don't know that just ignoring it is the right thing to do, because it, for somebody who's aware of this and is reading our presentation, they'll just find that strange. We don't even acknowledge its existence. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but that strikes me that way, and I'm not quite sure how to.
I wonder how we handled the LaBrie thing. I think we changed it over time, but do we even mention the first LaBrie paper? Do you remember, Barry?
We probably did, because that was the first and at the time only trial that claimed it was a randomized trial and claimed to show a benefit. And so that was circulating through the urology community, and we felt that it needed to be addressed because it was so seriously flawed and was being misinterpreted as a positive report from a randomized trial. Here it's a little bit different, since this is not being reported as a randomized trial. On the other hand, it was reported in a very prominent journal and got press pickup. And so, I don't know. There's a lot of, it wasn't reported as a randomized trial. I see a reason for not referring to it. I see a reason for saying that it's out there and giving a, basically saying it was not an ITT analysis and subject to important limitations. But before we come to a conclusion, Phil wants to say something. He is one of the authors of correspondence to the authors.
Yes, I have. Well, first of all, I agree with the concerns that Don and Tim both mentioned. This bothered me, I guess, on a basic level of the definition of their MLT. So it seems as though they are trying to use this MLT, this mean lead time, which is different from the usual mean lead time you see in the literature, as a sort of a proxy or surrogate for mortality, for an outcome of a trial. And the definition encompasses the whole diagnostic process, but it doesn't go beyond that. So their MLT, as I understand it, includes screening intensity and diagnostic workup and numbers of cases found, whatever the nature of those cases, and the more of that you get, the more MLT you get. And there's apparently a relationship from their modeling, where there's a direct correspondence between MLT and benefit. And I think it all comes out of Erspic. I think that's correct. And so if the MLT is zero, you get no mortality reduction. If the MLT increases, you get more mortality reduction. Well, the MLT, as I said, as I understand their definition, only involves components of the diagnostic process. It doesn't involve the characteristics of any cancers found. It doesn't involve treatment. So how it can actually model or imply what the mortality benefit will be without including those things isn't at all clear to me. I don't think it's really an appropriate surrogate measure. So that's sort of a general thing. But then if you consider, for example, the cases that are involved. So if you find, you do more screening, you do more diagnoses, more biopsies, to find more cases. What is the nature of those cases? Some of them might very well be overdiagnosed. This is the key thing that's not in there. Now, they do say in the appendix that all kinds of cases are included in their MLT, but they don't adjust for the fact that there could be differences in the distribution of the types of cases, in particular overdiagnosis. And as Barry pointed out, since the overdiagnosed cases are part of the measurement, but overdiagnosis is harm, they're including harm in their presumed indicator of benefit. And if you had two tests, one of which finds, say, the same numbers and types of true clinical cases, but one gets more overdiagnosis than the other one, it's going to have a larger MLT and imply more benefit, when in fact there can't be more benefit because the difference is only in overdiagnosed cases. So I think this is an invalid indicator of benefit. I think that the conclusion that the two trials were essentially equivalent may, in future analyses, if more data come out, in particular the treatment data from ERSBC, may find that that's really the case, that the trials are similar. But I don't think you can reach that conclusion based on this analysis. And there are a couple of other curious things about this that they don't really get into. One is time dependence. I mean, they pick a particular point in time, which is the 11-year data, and it's relatively complete data for both trials. Not unreasonable, but I'm not sure what they would have found had they looked at different points in time where the MLT would change, and I don't know how the correspondence would look with mortality at those points in time. The other thing is figure two. The figure is hard to read and to see the difference in the particular for PLCO in the curve, and they don't give you a table with numbers, but it almost seems to me that they're suggesting that the stream group is better than control in PLCO based on their approach, when in fact the data show just the opposite. So at a number of levels, I have a real problem with this paper.
So Don, let me very briefly talk about the correspondence. The person at the ASCO plenary session that commented on the brief paper was Peter Boyle. Peter Boyle co-authored a letter to the editor with Philip Outhier, which basically points out what he pointed out, 15 years ago, that the analysis was invalid because it severely violated the intent to treat principle. And so I'll tell you what some of the letter writers said. Phil's letter said what he just said. Peter Boyle and Outhier say, "We are not aware of any other trial report in which a randomization group variable is replaced by a variable representing a parameter calculated on the minority of subjects diagnosed with the disease in question. This replacement maneuver equates to assigning to subjects never affected by prostate cancer a statistical quantity that is entirely specific of subjects diagnosed with prostate cancer." And then goes on to the issue that Phil raised about overdiagnosis being incorporated and inseparable from the MLT. And as Phil said, he and I discussed it, and I pointed out, they're potentially including a harm as a benefit. Then Stuart Baker has a similar letter to the editor, and then there's one more letter to the editor from urologists who were doing high fives over this, saying, you know, basically, finally, the truth is out, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you might be interested, Don, in looking at the exchange of correspondence and then the response from the authors. And the authors who respond do not include Paul. But Ruth Etzioni and others did respond, and they basically, I thought that the response, in my opinion, reading it, was extremely anemic. In other words, they did not address head-on the core issues raised by the three critical letters. And so now we are faced with what to do. Do we ignore it? Do we refer to it and list it? Even Paul has said to me, he's also subdued, he recognizes the weakness in creating this MLT statistic, which has no prior literature to support it anyway, and says that's a weakness. But I am interested in what others feel. Do we ignore it or say that this article was reported but for the following reasons does not establish that the two trial results are actually equivalent, nor that there's a benefit associated with screening?
I would like to propose, thank you, Barry, I would like to propose that we do include it and that we refer to the letters indicating our inclination that the letters have the right answer.
So something like, while a recent publication suggested blah, 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 several letters of the editor raised serious doubts, therefore we think there is no benefit to screening. Something like that.
Well, I don't know the last phrase, but and I would put a somewhat more negative connotation indicating our inclination toward the viewpoints of the letters, which we wouldn't use the word debunk, but that debunk the original article.
Yeah, and as a statistical model, you know, it's,
right.
You know, we need to identify the statistical model. Pam, you had a comment.
Has the correspondence been published yet?
I got it online.
Okay, so it has been.
So the answer is yes.
So I was thinking that maybe we give it a few months, maybe 6 months, see if there is, if the urology community reacts to the correspondence, if this continues, the discussion continues. I'm more in favor of leaving it out to not give it any airtime. But I also think that if it keeps coming back, then we need to include it. Other question: is this the sort of thing that would be appropriate for JNCI News?
No, I don't think so.
Well, yes, but with the discussion,
Well, we're talking about doing that in the PDQ. Here's
right,
my inclination.
But what I'm thinking is that you get more readership.
Yeah. Here's my inclination. The urology community, those that have weighed in, are already doing high fives and saying this is the definitive proof that it works. And that's not going to go away. So I'm inclined to put it in, and if nothing comes out in the literature,
take it out.
Then take it out rather than the other way around. Okay? So, Don?
Why don't we just put it in and leave it in? Isn't this just sort of normal science, and can't we do this fairly just by addressing here's what we think the counter arguments are? This is already high visibility because it's in the annals, and I think it would be useful to address. I don't understand why it's so delicate.
Yeah.
It's delicate. It's more that there are two clinical trials, two RCTs. One was done really well. And we have those. We discussed those. And shouldn't that be enough?
Well, you mean putting into the BDQ?
No, shouldn't just have discussing PLPL and RSPEC. What's in there now? Discussion of the two trials, their strengths and weaknesses. Do we want to bring it up again when we have the original data?
This is a big paper that got a lot of pickup. I'm inclined to put something in there about it.
Are we going to change anybody's mind by putting it in there?
No, but we'll squeeze our springs a little bit, and at least people who are interested enough to read the PDQ can find out what some of the serious problems are. So, Don, maybe what you can do is craft some language for a discussion over the two. You know, it's interesting that it got through a generally well peer-reviewed journal. It just shows you the power of statistics that sometimes are black boxes. You know, this issue of MLT should have caught more attention. Inventing a new parameter, not giving a thought as to what goes into the parameter, and leaving themselves open to this criticism.
It's the power of the impact factor.
Well, that's it, too. There's something you said.
And that's unfortunate because they would continue to have a high impact factor even if they didn't publish it.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so I think we have a plan.
I'll do that, Barry. And Lisa, could you send me the letters that have appeared, please?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I might loop a couple of their board members in.
Okay,
yeah. Good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's move on to colorectal cancer screening, and this is David. This is a recommendation from a multi-center task force, multi-society task force.
Good. So this is the recommendations from not the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, but from the multi-society task force, which now is mainly GI docs. And while I think this is really interesting, and the group is going to be very curious to learn about this, we don't normally review other people's recommendations, and I'm curious, Barry or Lisa, do you have any special things that you want me to focus on here, or whoever suggested this? I've got a number of things that I think will be interesting to say, but I don't envision us writing about this, but I think it's very fascinating background about what happens to the evidence that others generate and that we review when it gets incorporated into guidelines like this. But Barry or Lisa, do you have any special things that you want me to focus on here?
Well, I didn't put it on the agenda. We sent it out as a mailing, but I actually wouldn't have put it on the agenda.
Can I go ahead anyway and just report it? I think it'll be interesting. I don't think it's going to end up though in what we write.
Okay, go ahead.
So this is for our group. This illustrates some of the problems with guidelines making. You'll remember, and this is going to end up being a very weak guideline, but it's extremely influential. And you'll remember that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force guidelines in 2016 said that ultimately that any of seven strategies of colon cancer screening, fecal immunochemical testing, sigmoidoscopy, colonoscopy, stool DNA, CT colonography, and so forth, is okay. And the method that they use is to review evidence in a systematic way, roughly as prescribed by the Institute of Medicine, quantitative modeling to try to understand benefit and harm as if a clinical trial was done, because there's not clinical trial data to support all of the decisions. And then they had some criteria for deciding where to draw the lines. And there were some issues with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force about exactly what those criteria were and where the lines could get drawn. But in general, they do a quantitative, explicit analysis. This guideline is very, very different, and it's extremely influential. And just to tell you what the results were, the end product is very, very different. They created in the end something called three tiers based on, quote, performance features, costs, and practical considerations, and they end up recommending colonoscopy every 10 years and fit annually. Other tests don't get recommended so well. They basically boil this down to two tests. And when you look and ask, well, what are the methods by which you reach this? You consider outcome, is there a quantitative analysis, and so forth. And their methods are that they obtain consensus through joint teleconferences. And there's really no detail about explicit criteria for reviewing data, systematic review like the IOM suggests, any kind of quantitative analysis, any link to outcome at all. And this is really an extraordinary way in the modern era to make guidelines, especially for something like screening, where we're used to the sophistication, even if it ain't perfect, of what the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force attempts. and what the IOM endorses. If you do a word search on this document and try to figure out, well, you've got three tiers and only the first tier is what you're really recommending, how do you get into it? You can't find any statement of criteria about what separates one tier from another. If you look, do a word search on rules or criteria or quantitation, none of that is there. So, and the last thing is, this multi-society task force is now, if you look at the author list, it's all gastroenterologists. When this started out in 1996, it's done about four iterations of colon cancer screening. It started off as gastroenterologists and generalists, including Bob Fletcher, Fiona Godley, Stephen Wolf, and one other, people who've been on the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and it evolved over time to lose all the generalists and methodologists. And just to conclude, this represents sort of, in the guidelines-making world, how guidelines-making is basically the Wild West, and if you make a society and decide to make guidelines, which they've done, there's no peer review of these things. And there is no central place that tries to understand quality of guidelines and critiques them. And this ends up being the end product that helps drive practice. And it's sort of a fascinating issue in what I think is sort of the debasing and corrupting might be a little bit strong, but of the guidelines making process, very different from IOM standards, which are hard to apply. And just sort of an interesting evolution for this whole group. Again, I don't think there's a place for it in PDQ, but in the field, this is a really, really big, interesting evolution of how this task force has evolved.
Interesting.
Barry, I don't know if you have any comments or other thoughts about this.
Well, I agree with everything you said, and I also agree that it's a huge driver of practice. And in the world of oncology, we have the NCCN, which is a group of basically non-methodologists, medical oncologists, who simply sit in a room and they respond very rapidly to literature that supports their opinion. And they put out these algorithms for how cancer patients should be managed, and they somehow engineered it so that their decisions have to be covered by Medicare. And it's almost like the AMA deciding how much it should be paid for the procedures that doctors do. Go ahead.
Barry, I was talking with someone who sits on that committee recently, and this person said the way that the NCCN reaches its decisions is if there's, it's like an 80% consensus, and the main thing that people are concerned about is, here's something I want to do, I want to make sure that it gets reimbursed.
Exactly.
I think in its defense, and I wouldn't defend it very strongly, the NCCN is mainly about treatment of people who have cancer. So I think the rules are a little bit different about harm versus benefit and so forth. It's still, in the great scheme of things, a kind of crazy way to make guidelines. And yes, they're terribly influential, and it's a fascinating universe.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks. Sounds like we have similar opinions. Any other discussion on that? And it's not going away, because often the third-party payers just simply defer to specialists who want to decide what they should get paid for. Okay.
I think it's fascinating that there's not much indignation or concern that this is the way that things work. I think it's just over people's heads, and it's a gigantic problem that's totally unregulated by the profession.
Yeah.
We as a profession don't have much desire to handle this differently.
That's the sad truth. All right. Let's see.
I've got two others, Barry, that I can be brief with.
Right, good.
So the next article is called Reanalysis of All-Cause Mortality in the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force 2016 Report on Colorectal Cancer Screening. And it's a two-page letter in the Annals of Internal Medicine that I don't think has a major conclusion that's going to change anything, that it's sort of cute and interesting. And the basic thing that they're saying that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force in 2016 said that there's no colon cancer screening strategy that reduces all-cause mortality when they review the clinical trials, when the task force reviewed them. And what these folks are saying is, well, you know, we reviewed four clinical trials about sphygmoidoscopy screening and reached your conclusion. And what these authors said is, but you made a mistake because one of the trials, the NORCAP trial, this is the Norway trial, is really not one study, but it's two studies because it started with one group and then years later they added another group that had somewhat different age and somewhat different ratio of treated to untreated. And what this group said in the letter was, if you look at the two of those groups combined, it looks like the control group has a is favored when you combine them. But if you separate out, this is in Figure 1, if you look at the relative risk in the aggregate outcomes, that's in the lower right-hand corner of Figure 1, the control group gets favored in terms of death. But if you look at the group separately, that's the top part of Figure 1, where the central point of the two groups, the first two lines, are to the left of 1.0. They say, if you look at these groups separately, there is a protective effect, and that this is what Simpson's paradox is. And I'm not going to be able to explain Simpson's paradox in a sentence. Don or Phil or Tim might be able to. I've tried going over several examples of this, but this is a phenomenon that really occurs, that sometimes groups get combined that reach similar results in one direction, but when you combine them because of differences within the kinds of patients included, where the result is opposite when you look at the two separate studies. At any rate, if you go on to the next page, Figure 2, and look at what happens in the figure when you count NORCAP, that's the Norwegian trial at the top, and as two separate trials, both of the central tendencies appear to the left of 1.0, and at the very bottom you get a protective effect, and they say, well, here's evidence that a screening modality provides protection from all-cause mortality. And I think, you know, I think this was in the Annals because it's sort of interesting and it's unusual. I think in the great scheme of things, this isn't that important, although we might mention it in a sentence, for two reasons. One is the protective effect, if it's there, is pretty small. The other is that if it's there, we don't know why it's there, although we don't really have to explain that. But the most important thing is that we don't really require this for adopting strategies for screening anyway. It's sort of an interesting quirk. And given that it's statistically significantly present, but clinically not that big in terms of significance, I just don't think it's worth that important. I don't think it's worth that much effort, but we could put in a sentence about it. And that's my thoughts about it.
David, Tim Church, I totally agree with your assessment of what the paper is saying, but I think it's important for two reasons. One is a lot of the people who still criticize the idea of screening for colorectal cancer have pointed to the fact that nobody's been able to show any decrease in overall mortality, and they use that to support the idea that the differences in that we're seeing in cause-specific mortality are more due to misclassification of death than to any real effect. And this handily puts to rest that potential criticism.
Okay.
So I think it does have, I think it may be worthy of presentation. The second thing I take away from it is, one of the criticisms I made of the ERSPEC trial was that they treated it as one big trial.
Yeah.
But this shows that you can't do that if the randomization ratios aren't the same. You can run into the Simpson's paradox.
Yeah.
And so it makes a larger point the other point that the analysis of the earthquake trial has been wrong. Oh,
interesting. Tim, if you divide up the earthquake trial into the seven trials, how dramatic are the, not to dwell on this, but are the results very, very different from the...
I don't know. They haven't presented those results, so I don't know. Every time I've asked someone involved...
But they've never even done it.
No. Not as far as I know. I haven't seen the results. And every time I've asked someone involved about it, they've waved their hands at it. They say, well, I'm going to change the results.
Interesting.
All right, so David, you want to craft some language?
I will do that.
Okay, thank you.
Can I present my last thing that's scheduled at 3:00? Because I've got to go run a meeting at 3:00.
Okay.
And this last thing will be very brief. It's about stomach cancer.
Okay, wait, before we go to that, I wrote a note at the top of this paper that you just presented. They use a fixed effects model, and I wonder if that's appropriate since they were trying to, they were combining quite, they said they were combining different studies and different from different populations.
Then no, the answer is no. They should have used a random effects model, which means that their statistical significance will disappear.
Yeah, that's exactly
bye-bye.
The implication.
Well, they say that their I squared is equal to zero, so... That would justify a fixed effects model.
Well, but the whole reason they did it was they thought they were dealing with different populations.
And they want but
the same effect. I mean, the whole thing depends on the effect being correlated with the population.
I see. Okay.
But yeah.
Okay. All right. David, you want to present your next paper.
Yes, please. And this can be very brief. This is the article that was going to be presented at 3:05 or something like that about the effectiveness of Helicobacter pylori eradication in the prevention of primary gastric cancer in healthy asymptomatic people. This is a meta-analysis comparing risk ratio with risk difference, and it basically... It's going to end up being a relatively small study, but it's still an interesting topic. So the background is Helicobacter is associated with gastric cancer, but it's not clear if eradication reduces risk. This is a meta-analysis where they look at seven RCTs. Five are in Asia. One is from Czechoslovakia from 2001. Another is from another in Europe from 2005. So it's two old European studies and five from Asia. And we'll talk about quality in a minute because there's questions about it. But the overall result is that there's a relative risk of 0.67 in the treated group when you combine them all together. And you can look at figure 2 on page 11 of the article to see that. But the main problems among the main problems of this study are that the numbers of patients are very, very small. Let me see if I can find the table where that is. The follow-up is just on the order of 12 years, which is not very long. And this is if you look on page 7. These are the characteristics of the primary trials. Quality measures are lacking. A number of them weren't blinded. It's sort of, it's not clear how outcome was ascertained in all the patients and whether that might be related to blinding or not. And with five of these done in Asia and a number in China, I think those become more major issues. And I think they want to conclude that there is some reduction. They also speculate about the duration of protection and young people versus old people, and metaplasia versus continued infection, and so on and so forth. And these are all interesting issues, but it struck me as being an awful lot of speculation on a very small amount of data. And I thought this might be something that we could mention in a sentence, because in our current summary, we at least mention other meta-analyses. I think in the great scheme of things, this is too many studies that might not be relevant to us because of location, because of methods. Some of them are very old, and it's just small. They're just not big enough and long enough, I think, and well done enough to make a difference.
Okay.
It's an important topic. Yeah.
Well, so that means we wouldn't reference this. Is that what you're saying?
I would be happy to not reference it.
Okay.
It's an important topic for radar, but I don't think this does it.
Okay. That's good. Thanks for that brief, succinct summary. Okay, thank you. Now, the next topic is cigarette smoking, and we did get a note.
Oh, breast cancer.
Was that?
We skipped one, so we got to go back one.
I know, but I think that Michael Fuhrer is not going to be online, and he told us that we didn't...
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. All right, well then... Then, Michael, if you don't mind, we've got to go back to breast cancer prevention and Ishmael's article.
Yeah, no, I'm fine. I've been on for a bit. Thank you, and great discussions.
Okay, so the article that I reviewed was the article in JAMA Oncology by Laura Esserman and her colleagues. So this gets into the whole issue of overdiagnosis. Screening mammography. As everybody here is aware, that screening mammography has been associated with a substantial risk of overdiagnosis. Bleier and Walsh paper in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago suggested that about 30% of all breast cancers in the United States were overdiagnosed. So basically, the gist of this article is to identify patients who have a very, very, very low risk of recurrence, and to basically use this MammaPrint 70 gene expression score to identify patients who are at very, very low risk of recurrence. They refer to this as the ultra low risk group of patients who potentially wouldn't need any further treatment, and therefore, you know, if in fact this represents the overdiagnosis group, you could avoid, therefore, the burden of potential problems with overtreatment, overdiagnosis being associated obviously with overtreatment and the adverse consequences of overtreatment. So basically what they did is they looked at a trial. This is a Stockholm tamoxifen ST03-3 trial, which was undertaken between 1976 and 1990. And they used the MammaPrint score. So there were 1,780 patients. In the trial, they had 808 of these formal fixed paraffin embedded tissue blocks to work with from this trial. They excluded blocks with insufficient invasive tumor cells or blocks where the sample did not pass the MammaPrint quality checks. There were roughly 652 patients with MammaPrint response patients, 315 of them received tamoxifen, and 339 of them didn't. And then they were able to identify this ultra low risk group using MammaPrint. So basically, the ultra low risk group represented 15% of all the breast cancers, and the main point they bring out is that there are no deaths in the ultra-low-risk tamoxifen arm at 15 years, and these patients had a 20-year disease-free survival rate of 97%, whereas the untreated patient survival rate was 94%. Now, interestingly, in tumors that weren't ultra-low-risk, a tumor size greater than 2 centimeters was most predictive outcome. So what they argue is that if you take out the ultra low risk, there is some advantage to early detection, i.e., screening, particularly when it comes to this region of tumor size greater than 2 centimeters. But that kind of takes me back to Tony Miller's Canadian trial, where they looked at mammography screening plus clinical breast exam versus clinical breast exam alone, and seen that clinical breast exam canceled out the benefit of mammography screening in the Canadian trial. So this data would seem to kind of suggest that, you know, 2 centimeters is, in fact, screening the benefit. You don't need screening mammography. You don't need technology-based screening. You can use potentially something like screening clinical breast examination to as an effective tool to reduce mortality. And there are two ongoing trials in India assessing the role of screening clinical breast exam. But anyway, the two areas of the house are low risk. They tended to be invasive double carcinomas. Mucinous types were absent. They tend to be obviously ER positive, and the luminal subtypes, and they go on to different types of the category of tumors. You know, in their conclusion, what they argued is that they said we've used the molecular classifier to demonstrate long-term tumor behavior. Fact two, integrating the screening treatment trials can prevent inadvertent overtreatment and enable excellent outcomes with less toxic effects. So I think I would be a little bit more cautious in the conclusion. What I would argue is that this is kind of a hypothesis-generating paper, and in fact, we want to know if this group can avoid those signals. We would have to take these patients out and do a randomized trial to see whether or not we can avoid treatment of these patients and if the outcomes are in any way impaired by not treating these patients. So again, they've identified ultra-low risk group using the Stockholm trial, using Nanocrine 70, where essentially risk of recurrence is measurable, and they argue that these patients, this method can be used to identify patients and screen populations that are overdiagnosed and perhaps don't need to be treated. But again, I think we put this into the PDQ. I would put it in with a caveat that this is hypothesis generating, so it's not really ready for prime time. It's something that would need further validation.
Okay. So Ishmael, this is Don. I agree with the hypothesis generating and maybe should be confirmed in the U.S. population or later something more modern. However, we should not recommend a randomized trial. You couldn't do a randomized trial with breast cancer or mortality as an endpoint because it doesn't happen. So look in other databases and other trials to sort of confirm and update this, but don't recommend a randomized trial.
What about a non-inferiority trial? Would that be feasible for the others or not?
Well, you could do non-inferiority, but it's the same problem. The events are just not there. You're going to have, a 50,000 patient trial or something.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah. And, of course, the Holy Grail, if you're really talking about lesions that are overdiagnosed, is not to do the surgery in the first place. It would be to do a needle biopsy, as we do with prostate cancer, and then say we have accumulated enough information that it may be safe to follow this entity. And that would be true overdiagnosis because, of course, some people would say these are not untreated lesions. They were all excised.
So that's being done with the DCIS, COMET 12, the lower stump floor trial. So with DCIS, we have three trials ongoing doing that very thing.
Right. Now, someday we may be able to do what we're doing with prostate cancer, that is, inch up beyond DCIS to small stage one invasive cancers as they're now doing with prostate cancer.
So with the DCIS trials, what is the outcome? What's the end point?
With what?
The DCIS ones?
They already know that mortality is going to be virtually zero.
Right.
I think it's recurrence.
Yeah.
But the DCIS trials are very different. So for example, the Lourdes trial, the Lourdes trial, the Lourdes is the UK trial, the Lourdes is the kind of European trial. They're looking at low grade DCIS. Observation versus standard treatment, essentially. Whereas the COMET trial is looking at tamoxifen versus standard treatment. Now, they're treating these lesions in the same way you would treat, as in a prevention trial. Mm-hmm. So tamoxifen versus standard treatment. So I think the better trials are actually the European trials, the Lourdes and Lourdes trial, which are really looking at, no treatment at all, just observation, just screening with mammography.
Right.
Versus that treatment. I think they're going to give us a real answer versus the COMET, the American trial, which has got tamoxifen in the control arm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the endpoint is recurrence for all three trials.
Yeah. I know a lot of women will find that to be useful information. I mean, I know you can't, ideally we'd do mortality, but breast cancer, most people don't die of breast cancer anymore, but I bet it's useful to know.
Well, none of the GCS trials, of course, have shown any mortality, you know, differences because of, you know, the Don pointed out for a lot of these things that there is no mortality. So with GCIS, you know, there is no mortality, and so we don't see mortality differences in any of the GCS trials. It's just been differences in recurrence risk.
Right. To me, ultimately, the differences in invasive recurrence, not simply recurrence of another overdiagnosis, you know, of a lesion that may just be overdiagnosis. Okay, great. So you're going to craft language or edits. Thanks.
Yes, I'll open.
Great. Thank you, Rishnoff. Now we're on to...
Barry, I'll have to get going because I'm going to get back to clinic, but I'll find out the point. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
When cancer stops becoming a fatal disease... Is mortality still the end point of interest?
Why would it stop becoming fatal?
Well, because of the treatment.
Then you don't have to. If treatment works,
then you don't. Treat, you know, then you're
more. So I guess we won't use mortality because you won't get it.
Yeah, these trials are treatment trials with watchful waiting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Cigarette smoking cessation, Michael.
Hi, everybody. So why don't I start where I'll end up and then give you my rationale. So I'm going to recommend that we not alter the smoking cessation document upon this article. So my rationale. This is, I think, a really important, well-written, balanced, and very clear article, and it provides some very helpful information on an incredibly complex and controversial topic, and that is what is the role of e-cigarettes in terms of serving as a smoking cessation aid. So this article is a population-based epidemiologic analysis. It uses an excellent data source, the CPS, the Current Population Survey. It primarily compares data from 2014-2015, when there was quite extensive use of cigarettes, with 2011, when there was less use of e-cigarettes. It's a population-based survey. It includes over 160,000 individuals. There are 23,000 adult smokers in the sample, including 2,100 recent quitters. So large numbers and representative. Their overall conclusions are that it also has a very large number of people who ended up using e-cigarettes during this period. And that includes 38% of the current smokers in 2015 also reported having tried e-cigarettes, and about 50% of recent quitters reporting that they had tried e-cigarettes. So their major findings were that e-cigarette users were more likely than non-users to attempt smoking cessation, 55% versus 40%, and they were more likely to succeed in quitting, 8% versus about 5%. And they also noted a significantly higher rate of smoking cessation across the full population of smokers in 2015, about 5.6% versus 2011, about 4.5%, and that translates into hundreds of thousands of additional quitters. So basically, they drew correlations and found that those who used e-cigarettes were more likely to try to quit and more likely to succeed. The problem, of course, is that it was not a clinical trial. The individuals were not randomized, and there were a whole series of other factors that may have, and they acknowledge very well in their limitation section, may have contributed to this. For example, most of data on examining the effects of e-cigarettes on smoking cessation, compare it with using another treatment for smoking cessation, whether it's an evidence-based counseling treatment or an FDA-approved smoking cessation medication that's been documented as safe and effective. This, of course, compares it to everybody else in the mix, not just those who used another treatment. There were substantial temporal factors ongoing, including a hundreds of millions of dollar campaign by the CDC called TIPS, Tips from Former Smokers, that was running and was driving more people to make quit attempts. So while I think these findings are, you know, very well done, well presented, important, in terms of making clinical recommendations, the lack of this being a trial where individuals were randomized, to me, keeps it from warranting a recommendation. And the hornet's nest of recommending e-cigarettes in a PDQ document is one that I would suggest is made only with substantial, well-done, and multiple studies. And that brings me to something I think I mentioned the first time, or was asked the first time I attended a meeting in early summer, and that is the current smoking cessation document is outdated, and I've committed to Barry and to update that in 18 by the end of the year to have a draft for the group to consider doing a comprehensive redo of this one that reflects data in the last 10 years. Some of the data that's in this is 30 or 40 years old, so it needs an update, and it'd be a privilege to do that.
Much appreciated. Important topic and should really be kept up to date. Michael, let me change the topic a little bit. Thanks for the presentation, but I know that you have been part of the group that has participated in the Dickensian case of the United States versus Philip Morris that has finally wound down with an agreement to have television ads and magazine ads from the tobacco company saying that they misled the public and so forth. Corrective statement. One thing that occurs to me is that I always assume that tobacco company executives that get paid millions of dollars a year are pretty darn smart, and they're constantly trying to figure out an angle. And here's one. In this day and age, it's easy to put a corrective statement just before or right after an ad of a very happy lung cancer patient playing with his grandchildren because he just got chemotherapy. And I wonder if there is a way to guard against or prevent that juxtaposition to give a totally misleading impression that if you get lung cancer, not to worry, you'll still be happy, active, and getting cured. Is there a way to avoid that?
This whole issue of these corrective statements, which were one of the key outcomes of the trial that found the tobacco industry guilty of racketeering, These corrective statements have been tied up with tobacco industry lawyers for almost a decade. It really is, it's been a tragedy, and it's been an endless series of what always happens with the tobacco industry, an endless series of litigation to font size, to font type, which newspapers it will be in. The list goes on and on. We just had at the Humphrey Building recently a report from the Justice Department on the long process that it took to do this. There's no way that that set of agreements that took 10 years to litigate are going to be changed. I don't know if there was any specific language around juxtaposing other advertisements. I suspect there isn't. But while it's a good thought, I think there is essentially no chance of achieving your noble suggestion.
Well, that's too bad. So I'm going to make a prediction. My hypothesis is there'll be non-random distribution of these corrective statements on television vis-a-vis these ask your doctor ads, because you too could get cured of lung cancer. Okay, well, let's move on to oral cavity and oropharyngeal cancer prevention. Doug.
Hi, good afternoon. So this is tangentially related to my area at HPV. And this is a study from the Nutritional Health and Nutritional Examination Survey that was conducted between 2011 and 2014. And basically the unmet question is whether HPV prevalence regarding oral HPV infection is similar between men and women. And since that's not my particular area, the article will tell us that the data breaking down this distribution by sex is not well documented, and so I'll take them at their word for that. And so they just basically wanted to see what the risk factors were for HPV infection as determined between men and women. And they looked at the I don't know how you say this, NHANES study. Maybe you guys pronounce it differently. And this study included both demographic data, self-reported sexual activity data, and specimen collections for HPV testing from both oral and genital areas. It was a representative national survey, and their main findings were that the prevalence of HPV was 11% in men and 3% in women. And then they go on to look at a lot of covariates, such as sexual orientation, number of sexual partners, types of oral, vaginal versus anal sex, sexually transmittable diseases, same-sex partners, and frequency of partners in the past 12 months versus lifetime. And basically all the things that we know about HPV and sexually transmittable diseases and HIV, to my understanding, are pretty much mirrored here. You know, more sexual partners, same-sex partners, risk of STDs all increase your risk of HPV, and particularly high-risk oral HPV infections. And in the oral cavity, HPV 16 is really the main culprit, unlike in the cervix, where we have a number of different high-risk subtypes. However, the remarkable feature, at least it seemed remarkable to me, was that the prevalence of HPV infection was many-fold greater in men than women, on order of, you know, 4 to 10-fold greater for whichever measure you look at, either at baseline or with the risk factor in question. And so their conclusion is that HPV infection is common among men, and they say that this has implications for prevention efforts, but I think our earlier discussion today sort of said that right now we don't have screening efforts for oropharyngeal cancers. So maybe in the future that will be useful. I don't think this adds, this does add new data. I'm not sure, we weren't really sure when I got to review the article, it wasn't really clear where this data might get put. It's certainly background data. You know, it could be background data in the head and neck prevention topic, but it's not really a prevention, you know, study. It's more an epi study. And I would say the main limitation of the paper was just that it didn't feel like they gave any sort of reasonable explanation for why they, you know, saw the difference in men versus women. No biologic rationale. But other than that, I think it adds to available data and gives us a more up-to-date and accurate frequency of HPV infection between men and women. And the one thing I forgot to mention also, they also looked at a correlation between genital HPV infection and oral HPV infection. And as you might expect, there was an association. And again, this association was stronger among men than women. And they look at other covariates that I don't think I really need to go into, like age, race, and other things, and cigarette smoking.
Great. So let me ask, I hope Jenny is still on the line.
Yeah.
Do you think that a sentence or two or three from Doug would fit anywhere into your head and neck statement for who's at risk?
Yeah, I think on page 12 of the prevention document, there's a general statement about HPV and the risk of certain types of squamous cell cancers. So we could say that it's more common in men.
Great.
12 of the prevention document.
Yeah, of the prevention document on page 12. Your old version, my version. Sorry.
Oh, okay. My version only has 12 pages.
Yeah, my version is number 7 document.
Okay.
So, Doug, maybe you can craft some language and insert it into the statement or send it to Jenny so she can determine the ultimate
place. I think it might be worth holding off on this. I'm a little worried that I'm a little worried that some of the stuff, I mean, what they did is that they pooled a couple cycles of NHANES together and did boo-koodles of testing, you know, and then their prevalence model is based on pairwise association and, you know, model selection kind of things. The nice thing about this is you can redo, I mean, every 2 years, another independent sample of NHANES comes out that's a perfect validation sample. And so if it were up to me, I would say, I love this paper. I'm going to put it on a shelf until the 2017 cycle comes out, and then I'm going to go run it and see if I get the exact same thing as they did. If I do, that's some evidence. If I don't, that's what I kind of expected because they did a whole lot of hypothesis testing and a whole lot of model selection in doing this. I mean, anytime you see something that's got tables that this many, this teeny tiny little type and this many p-values written in there, it bugs me. I know Don doesn't care, but I think, you know, the rest of us do.
Another Arnold paper.
Well, Don, what do you feel about that?
No, I agree with Kevin.
Okay. All right.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do they do this type of collection every cycle with the at least with the oral swabs and the sort of sexual activity inventory, and could you not just go back to the prior cycle and do the analysis today rather than waiting 3 years for the next cycle?
The 2017 is already, I mean, they're already putting that together, but yeah, I think that's the question is you can go to the NHANES website and you can see exactly what they do and how and where they, and what cycles they put these in. Sometimes they may have some on and off kind of things. So it may be that they didn't have it in the 2009-10, but they may have started it. All I'm saying is that there's a chance that I mean, you can put it in there, but if you do it, make sure you caveat it and say there's, you know, based upon this one survey or this one analysis, it looks like this. We're still waiting to see if the predictive part bears out in following cycles. That it would be a bare minimum, I would say, before you specify anything out of this paper.
But the key elements that we may want to retain is the difference, the bisex difference, that's not modeled, that's observed prevalence rates, and also the high prevalence rate in men.
Right.
So that might be something to put in there without putting in all the model predictive factors.
Right. And you know, if you were going to be really, really super careful, you'd whip out the old Benjamin Hochberg procedure and see if the sex difference was, if it was the biggest one and the P is less than a bajillion, you know, a teeny tiny bit.
Yeah.
And then you might say, okay, we might actually call the significance, even adjusting for multiple testing, which they did not do, I feel certain.
Uh-oh.
So
an additional thing to address is something we're not going to have time for today, the multivariate modeling.
Uh-huh.
And when you put these other things, you know, for example, sex difference may be due to, in part, to the same sex issue and homosexuality. And if you adjust for these things, you might get misleading answers, and if you don't adjust, you will definitely get misleading answers.
This is Tony Allberg. In epidemiology, a lot of times we rely on consistency of findings across different studies, and the sex difference observed here has clearly been observed in many other studies previously. What this adds, and why it merited publication in a high-impact journal, is that it's a national sample verifying this rather than some of the select populations that have been studied before. So I think that gender difference is very interesting, and if it's not in PDQ, it really merits mention, and the other parts of the paper are less relevant.
Okay, in that case, so
Tony, I agree that it's so big that there has to be something there. But the general issue and the showing consistency across trials, I mean, if everybody does, which they do, these adjustments, they're all falling prey to the same fallacy.
Right. So the real question really is, you know, it's one thing to say, we see this. And you know, if they had said, these are hypotheses that we're going to look at in NHANES, because we've seen all this, let's test it in a population study, and you had a targeted thing, that's one thing. Then you could talk, use NHANES as confirmatory. But what they did for at least the predictive modeling was very exploratory, not confirmatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so you definitely want to leave that out.
So we're going to leave that out, but the question is, should we put in the sex difference in the prevalence rates into PDQ? And I've heard it go in both directions, but I think more people say yes than no.
I'm okay with putting them in there as mm-hmm. long as you say these are the observed rates.
Yes.
And they were like, and say, this is for this survey, this is the observed rates, and you can give them how much. That's all fine.
Good.
But I think you want to be really careful about diving in and assuming that every time they find something significant that it's really there.
All right.
And so as long as you restrain yourself, you're fine.
All right, Doug, you incorporated all that?
Got it.
Okay, thanks. And the only thing I'd say as a suggestion is if the NHANES data is out or about to be out, why don't you work with Vic Sahasrabhuti to see if it can be replicated?
That's something we certainly can do. I love working with NHANES. NHANES is fun.
Okay.
Good day.
Okay, seek out Vic. I'm sure he'd be happy to work with you. I think we were going to use the remainder of the time to discuss the obesity or overweight and Cancer Association. We'll have to defer that. That's a much more complicated issue. But I know Don and I think it was Tony were going to talk about what we do, about what we make of the association and the interventions. Because I think Don is correct in that the evidence that actual weight loss leads to the reduction of these and the risk of these cancers is very, very slim, and we need to be very careful about that. Well, you presented a paper from a cohort study, and you decided that it was too weak to even include.
Yeah, it was weak.
And that's only for the one cancer that has the so-called strongest evidence, endometrial cancer.
Yeah.
So we'll put that on the agenda for next time, okay?
Yeah.
All right, and we all survived a fire and got through all the papers. Thanks for joining us.
It was a false positive.